Hey everybody, welcome to Bidum Biz. This is Paul O'Keefe and I'm here with Anthony Frieda. And we're going to do a little bit of talking today about music in film and TV. Everything surrounding that, or favourites or least favourites. And I think it would be cool to maybe talk about some original pop songs or rock songs in TV and film too. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Ant, how's it going?
What's up, Paulie?
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. Great. I'm glad that glad we're getting in spring here. I don't care if my eyes are itchy,
right?
Or I'm sneezing. It's worth it. Yeah. Anything was better than this past winter, man.
Yeah, I
know we talked about this the last time, but I don't give a shit. It was that bad.
It's definitely better than it's definitely better than the alternative, which was just terrible. Terrible all around.
Yeah.
So we're both. Well, I'm semi-vaccinated. You're fully vaccinated.
No, I got one shot. Oh, we both got a semi.
Both have a semi. We both have a semi. So that's cool. So, I mean, because it's quite topical. We're recording this on what date is it today, Anthony? It's the 25th of April, right?
Wow.
So shit. We just went in New Jersey. We just went, and everybody else, for vaccines. So, I had my first shot on Friday, and it's now Sunday, and I was wiped the fuck out all weekend. I still encourage everybody to do it. Vaccines have side effects. All vaccines have side effects, but I was wiped out. I don't know what your experience was, but I was completely 100% wiped out all weekend. It was hard.
My arm really hurt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been having physical issues in general, and this just made all that worse. So I guess, and I was a little fatigued too. So it was, you know, hey, I think I expected it, you know, right. After 2 days I was fine. Yeah. So yeah, it was worth, but it's worth it. And I don't know how you felt, but I felt a little bit of a feeling of like a little bit of a sigh of like, oh my God, all right, there is an exit, or there is something.
Yeah.
We are going to get past it. I know it's just a shot. It's just one shot and it's just a vaccine, but the thought that seeing all of the people in that building who were just, it was so organized, and the amount of people that they were giving shots to, it just in that 30 minutes of time, there had to be like 30 of us in there, and it was in like a whole entire school.
Okay.
And a gymnasium. I mean, it was just, that made me feel good. Yeah. Basically is what I'm saying. All that effort, and how smooth it was.
I got mine done at a pharmacy that will remain unnamed, a chain pharmacy. And it was, I had the same experience. I was impressed by the organization. I was impressed with the fact that they had, I mean, obviously the person doing the vaccination was an expert, but the fact that they had the retail staff of this, you know, retail pharmacy kind of doing a lot of the work and a lot of the legwork it's such a machine that's just been put into operation. It's very impressive. And
you know,
I had the same experience. I mean, so the way that the vaccine works for anybody that hasn't had it done yet is you get a little prick in you you then have to sit there for 10 or 15 minutes just in case you have any immediate side effects. And in the 10 or 15 minutes that I was sitting there waiting to see if I was going to grow an extra head or whatever, they did like 8 people in that.
Yeah,
time.
Right.
It's that quick. It's just boom, you're done. But the first night Friday, I was really, really, really tired. My arm hurt a lot the next day. Saturday, I just spent Saturday horizontal on the couch watching movies, which was just the best way of spending a Saturday. I wish I could get vaccinated every week.
Yeah, right.
But so it was good. So we're both halfway there. So we'll have a follow up on what the next one is like. But I was hoping that it would clear my erectile dysfunction.
There's a thing called Blue Chew.
Blue Chew.
Blue Chew, everybody. Right. Just go on bluechew.com/badumbiz for a 10%.
Yes, advertising. Advertising pitch.
No, do not do that. You will not get any discount.
Yeah, we should send them this episode and see if we can get a deal.
For real.
So, movies. I just mentioned I spent yesterday sitting watching movies. We touched a little bit on this in our previous episode together, and we both expressed deep appreciation for how sound and music, and I think both should be taken together. The sound of a movie, the soundscape of a movie, and the music in a movie. And I watched three movies yesterday, all with completely different soundtracks and all with completely different atmospheres. And we'll talk about them in turn. But I watched the new Mortal Kombat movie.
Oh, word.
I was a huge Mortal Kombat fan when I was a kid.
Was it good? Did you like it?
The movie was terrible, but I really enjoyed it.
Just wait, hold on a second. That is awful. Exactly, this conversation mm-hmm. happened in the 90s when the first one came out, and that was exactly the same thing.
Exactly the same reaction everyone had.
Oh, look, my God.
Look, here's a good rule of thumb. If anybody anybody listening, any like art school students listening who are thinking of going into film or, you know, writing for film or directing or whatever, do yourself a favor and never make a movie of a video game ever, because they never work. It's a dead zone for movies. So the movie was absolutely terrible, and I enjoyed every single minute of it, because it was a pure geek out, you know?
Some
of my favorite characters were in it, and it was like some of the moves and some of the sounds and some of the, like it was a really oddly more religious adaptation of the video game than the original 90s, early 2000s movies. The soundtrack was great. It was an EDM soundtrack, which is what the sound, the music in the original video game was.
So was it... Was it that?
Yeah, it was like dance music. It was great.
Oh, no, wait. Is that the fucking right thing?
That's... That's the Twilight Zone by 2 Unlimited, I think.
Thinking about? Mortal Kombat, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's very, very similar. It's house. It's kind of hard house, I guess you would have called it. I don't think it exists anymore. Now it's just EDM.
Something like that, right?
So it was like the sound and the music was really good. So that was the first one. And then I watched Dune. So the David Lynch. So they're coming out with a new version of Dune soon.
Dune, okay.
Yeah, Dune.
Which one did you watch?
The David Lynch one from the 80s.
David Lynch.
Had Colin McLaughlin.
Oh, 84, okay.
Yeah, it had Patrick Stewart was in it. A whole mess of people were in it, but it was really good. Sting was in it.
Really?
Sting was in it and is oddly really good in it. But
really?
It's David Lynch, so it's equal parts genius and equal parts... please end soon. So it was really good. But again, the music, synthesizer 80s music, it was very it was like you could feel the music. There was only one soundtrack that this movie could have had, and it's that synthesizer John Carpenter kind of soundscape, which was really, really cool, very futuristic for its time. And then I watched a movie called Synchronic, which is it's like a time travel movie. So the movie is about these two paramedics who they get a spate of drug overdoses or a drug related injuries in New Orleans, and people are taking this drug called Synchronic, and depending on what your geographical position is when you take the drug, you go back in time.
What?
For 7 minutes. Yeah. So it's actually a really kind of cool high concept movie, but again, the music was just really, really good. Really, you know, it was very modern and very understated, but, you know, super, super interesting. So it was like three different, totally different soundscapes and totally different soundtracks, but it was awesome. But so I'm going to ask you.
Yes, sir.
So not forget about how good the movie was. What's your give me an example of one of your top, you know, movies with a great soundtrack and great sound that really stands out to you.
Oh man, I mean, the typical would be like Star Wars, of course. And as time has gone on, and the more, you know, over the years, like I had my geek moments, man, especially as a teenager, where I geeked out on Star Wars. I would play all these Star Wars video games, and while you're playing the game, sometimes, and this is what I like about how they make music happen in video games, is you'd enter a new part of the level, or you'd get into a battle or something, and the music would change.
Sure.
And depending on who was, you know, in the scene or who you're playing, the music would maybe have a specific type of like theme, let's say. So, you know, like Luke's theme.
Sure.
Right? Okay. That's Luke's theme. Leia and Han have their own theme. I think I'll try to sing it, but obviously Darth Vader. Bum, 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 oh, right?
So good. So good.
Dude, like, but every iconic scene visually has its own theme as well.
Yeah.
In the beginning of Empire Strikes Back, when they're going to Hoth, right? And there was something that crashed right on Hoth, and then they went out to go scout it out, and they're in their speeders.
Sure.
There's just like
they're in their speeders.
And then it's just like, I mean, it's so fucking cool, dude.
Yeah,
so
if
you know what I just attempted to sing, if you know it, you know it's good. And if you don't know it, you're just laughing.
So
I think Star Wars for sure. I would say my absolute favorite, though. Yeah, my absolute favorite is That Thing You Do.
Right. I actually watched, because I know that, just like sticking a pin in that for a second, a little bit of history. In our small circle of friends, a few of you guys have been talking about this movie for years and years and years, and I had never seen it. I've never seen this movie. And
you're welcome.
I watched it a few months ago, and it was I found it really, really good.
You're welcome.
And it was massively offensive to any bass players out there, considering the fact that they didn't even name the bass player. They just called him,
right? Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
It's so funny.
But, yeah, but I can see how you like it, because the whole story hinges around, I mean, the main character is the drummer, right?
Yeah, but that's funny. Like, that's the funny part. I think I identified with the good-natured personality of the drummer.
Sure.
Right? And the team effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it had really nothing to do... Well, I mean, it's weird. It's like I identify with that. That is my nature in general. And if you're a good drummer...
Sure.
You would be that way, because you want to keep your whole... You as a bass player as well. It's keeping things together.
Yeah.
Keeping things smooth. I mean... Even in the movie, like, there would be a conflict and he would not be confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
He would, you know, try to like be like a diplomat, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, yeah. But the best part of that movie, I don't know if you can agree with me, is obviously the soundtrack is great.
Wonderful.
The playing is great, right?
But it makes the songs are great.
And I didn't know this at the time because I was young. I might have been 7 or 8. When I first watched it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that, oh, they're actually playing, right? And they probably were playing and making sounds, but the sounds that we were hearing was recorded by professionals, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, they really taught that drummer how to play. And actually, I know who the drummer... There's a professional drummer named Billy Ward who taught that guy.
Right.
And Billy Ward's a monster, but watching him play visually and then hearing the music made me want to play drums for sure. That's what got me into it.
So that is it. That's the big bang of Anthony Frieda's drum career.
I think before watching that, I remember watching, like, I was even younger, watching like Nick at Night with my folks.
Sure.
And I Love Lucy was on, and I remember Little Ricky, the son. They sat him down on a drum set, and he's playing traditional grip, and he's just flying on a drum solo. And I remember thinking, like, that kid's my age. Like, I want to do that. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. Sure. So, yeah, that's probably my favorite, though.
It's great, and that's actually a kind of cool. I was trying to come up with a better word for your birth as a drummer, but it's cool to understand that about you, knowing you for as long as I have. I'm like, yeah, that actually makes total sense, because there's a part of the movie. I'm not spoiling anything because it was 15 years ago, right? This movie came out something.
Oh, dude, this came out like 20.
Really?
Am I wrong? 25 years ago? Something like that.
I have no frame of reference for time whatsoever. I still consider, like, the Black Album to be a more recent Metallica album. There's a part of the movie where they've got this song, and it's a decent song. It's an okay song, but the drummer plays something different on it. And I don't know if he asks him to
play that
a little faster, and then he does this drum beat. And it's very cool, because it's not often, even in music movies or music documentaries or anything to do with music, it's always like the singer does something, or the piano player does something, or they have like a epiphany moment or whatever. And it was just the epiphany in this movie was this guy had a great sense of groove and a great sense of rhythm and a great sense of how, you know, how the engine of a song can change and make it better just by changing a very, very simple thing in the song. And it was a great scene where he just starts playing this drum beat, and just the whole nature of the song changes. It's
well, the thing is he was supposed to be playing like a cross stick, you know. And if I know you, you're doing that. But it was like, know you, you're doing. It was like,
right.
Very like cocktail hour lounge kind of shit, right?
Sure.
And in rehearsal he was bored, right? But then on the performance, he hadn't performed for a while, so he was nervous. Mm-hmm. And that's, he counted it off, 1, 2, 3, and he just boom,
got right fast, gah, yeah, boom.
And dude,
yeah,
they like, I think that was the selling point, that right there, because
yeah,
watching the people start dancing to the drummer. And the band wasn't even like prepared to, you know what I mean? I remember thinking like, oh shit, you can make people dance.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
It was cool. And there was a lot of other like non-music elements to that movie, which I found very moving, which was like, one of the parts was, I think it was, there was an older female artist on the tour with them.
Yeah.
And she was on like the downside of her career. And I found that very, it was like sad and moving. And you know, I can see a lot of artists like that nowadays. I'm like, wow, that must be really hard to watch these up and coming artists as you're on the way down. And then there was just the way that, I mean, I'm trying to avoid spoilers, because you know, like, I didn't even see this movie till a few months ago, but the way that the whole thing kind of culminates, but it culminates with maturity, you know.
Yep.
I always imagined, you know, like looking at, like watching music movies or band documentaries or whatever, I'm like, oh, how heartbreaking must it have been for that band to break up? But it's the way that they deal with it is just very, everyone's very calm about it and everyone's very mature about it. And, you know, this guy actually just becomes an artist instead of just a drummer in a band, which was cool. You know, it was
and
really
shout,
cool.
Shout out to Tom Everett Scott. That's the actor.
Okay.
We're going to have him on this podcast one day.
We could, because he's never been in anything else since, I don't think.
That's not true. Yeah,
I haven't seen him in anything.
He was in, he's in a show recently with this comedic actress. I really like her, actually. She's so funny. Andrea Savage or something like that. And the show is called Sorry. He's like her husband. He's great.
Oh, okay.
He's great in it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I liked about it. I could really buy into it because I hadn't seen him in anything else.
Those actors, I mean, other than, I think the bass player was probably the most known. Like,
and
had
yeah,
been
and
in
was,
so many more things, at least that I saw
And who was the guitar player? Was somebody? Who was he?
Yeah, he was like an actor back then. I mean, I think he still acts, but he wasn't in a lot of stuff. Like, in fact, I think the bass player and the guitar player I had seen over the years in more films and shows.
I can't remember his name now for the life of me.
I don't remember his name.
But he was he's very funny. He was he's been in a lot of stuff.
The guitar player you're talking about, right?
The guitar player.
Steve, is his name Steve something?
Steve, I don't know. He was in a really good TV show called Wild Dogs or something. And okay. Mad Dogs or something like that, about this like group of male friends who go to Belize and they get like it's like The Hangover but in Belize. It's very funny, but I can't remember what his name is. But
Steve Zahn,
that's right.
Yeah, he's so funny. He was good. Dude,
it's very funny, very mad.
Captain Geach in the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
Yeah. But definitely check that movie out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, please do.
And just going back to the Star Wars thing.
Yeah, good idea.
I remember watching the final installment of the 9 movies and having this really great moment and kind of realizing it at the time, going, shit, that's really cool. It's my understanding that, okay, so you have your, you know, you have your theme music, you know, your identifiable theme music for every movie, you know, so like... you know, for 1990 Tim Burton, it was like the theme was... That's in the movie, okay? For Superman, you have the... Yeah, that's in the movie. Whenever he has that...
Is that how that goes?
Exactly. So, yeah, and they use it in that moment where he's coming every movie that Superman's ever had. He comes back from the dead, and that's the when he, you know, his revival in the movie. Star Wars has a great identifiable theme tune. Nobody needs to sing it because everybody knows it.
Yep.
Was never used in any of the movies as soon as the narrative started. It was never played until the last movie. You go back and watch all of the Star Wars movies, and that scene in the Rise of Skywalker movie, when all of the fleet arrive, that's the only time that the theme tune...
From the very beginning of the scroll?
So it's there, and then it's doing the scroll.
Sure.
But then as soon as the scroll's done, it's going, you know, it does all that. It does the kind of descending flute thing, and it's into the narrative. Mm-hmm. That theme was never, ever used in the narrative part of the movie until that scene in the last movie. And it was so moving because I was watching the movie. I was like, this is a really good movie. This is cool. And then that scene comes on and it's like, it was like,
I don't remember that. I guess I missed that.
It's the only time that the theme music is actually used within the movie.
Oh my God.
And apparently the whole thing was planned by John Williams.
When you think about like that, it's almost like, oh, there's no reason to, because there is so much other material. He came up with so many other themes.
Mm-hmm. And he had so many opportunities. Like, you think of all of the opportunities, like when Han Solo shoots the TIE fighters in the first movie, or, you know, not much of an opportunity in Empire, but in, like, Jedi, when, you know, they destroy the Death Star. It's never, ever used. He waited. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about... I mean, so John Williams always had, I've read that he always had the inclination that there was going to be an expanded, it was going to be expanded beyond the original trilogy. And he obviously did the music for all of the movies. And you think about it, the first one, he was created, what, 1977?
Yeah.
You know? So that's a long time ago. He held on to that moment for 9 movies.
That's wild. Then, yeah,
isn't it? Like, because you could at any time in any of the other movies, it could have gone this big hero moment, I'm gonna just blast in with the theme music. He held back until the last movie, and then as soon as the fleet shows up and it's the ultimate hero moment, and he just blew it. He just blasted the theme, and you're like going, shit, this is the first time the theme is actually
That's
played.
Wild.
Isn't that wild?
I didn't even pick up on that. I should go watch it again because
I mean, now
that I'm thinking about it, like Han and Leia's, right? That they have their love theme. There's this in when they're doing the last, when they're going through when they're going through the asteroids, for instance, remember that?
Yeah,
that has its own theme, like that has its own music to it. Oh man, if I can remember it. I mean, it's just wild, dude.
Wonderful.
Even the new
stuff,
I mean, and how old is this guy? That's the other, I always think about that. How old is John Williams?
I mean, he's got to be in his, I mean, I would say he's at least in his 70s.
Because he's been doing, he's been composing Star Wars music for longer than I've been alive, right? So
35 years, yeah.
No, way longer than that, right? 77.
70,
so it's gotta be like
almost 45 years.
45 years.
45 years.
Longer
45
than you've been
alive. Years. So basically the Rise of Skywalker or whatever it is was released 2 years ago. So 43 years he waited. He waited. I've got my theme and I'm going to wait to use it for the right moment. And that is, but that's why people like John Williams are people like John Williams, because any normal person would have just gone, I'm just going to blow it. I'm just going to, like, that, as soon as Han shoots that TIE fighter, I'm going to blast the theme music and everyone in the theater is going to be like, yes, amazing. Never did it. Held on to it, man. Watch the movie, watch the last movie, and you'll hear it. And it's just, it's very brief. But as soon as those ships come, so you see all the ships and then the Falcon comes down into screen. And you're like, wow, that's
amazing.
Really cool. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's the patience and the.
Let's stick with John Williams, because I've just pulled up everything he's done here. Like,
sure,
dude, Harry Potter. That's all I know of that. But I didn't really watch the movies. But I mean, so iconic, right?
Amazing.
Indiana Jones, by the way, too.
Indiana Jones. What was the music for that?
Let's see. Oh, bum, ba-dum, bum, dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun. It's kind of cowboy music, right? Dun, 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 dun. Like horse riding. Did he do E.T.?
He did E.T.
Incredible.
Amazing. Jurassic Park.
Oh my god! He did Jurassic Park too.
Yeah, man, he did. Dude, he did Superman.
He did the Superman theme as well.
Dude, think about this, man. Check this out. I'm gonna. Oh my god, this guy's a fucking monster. I feel so terrible about my life now, dude. Right. Check this out. This is what this dude is, dude. 77 Star Wars Episode 4. 75 Jaws. 77 Close Encounters of the Third Kind. 78 Superman. Like, dude, in a stretch of a couple years, the dude has done more than I've done in 30 years.
Unbelievable.
Real.
Like, you're just singing them off the bat. You just know, you know them all.
Man. Yeah, it's amazing. He did, he even did Rogue One.
He did the music for Rogue One as well.
He did Lincoln. He did Solo.
So great, awesome, John Williams, killer,
yeah, dude.
killer composer.
That
like
dude
the
is killing.
He's always the first guy that, I mean, if you do any discussion on film music, he's the first guy that you talk about. But then there's the second guy, and you know there's a greatest ever. There's a, you know, in any field there's a Tom Brady and there's a. Mm-hmm. Pelé, and there's a, you know, a Roger Federer or whatever, but that's not an interesting argument for me. The interesting argument is, who's the second best guy? So what we're going to do is we're going to count to three, and then we're going to say into the microphone who our second, like the number two music composer of all time for TV and film is, and then we're going to see what we come up with. All right. So
all right, I got to give me a second.
Okay, you got to.
I got to think about that. I think I know who I'm going to say, but mm-hmm. got to really think it over. Give me like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, play. What's it called? What song did we play? Bossa, Blue Bossa. All right, I think I got it. I think I got it, yeah.
Okay, here we go. After one, three, two, one, Hans Zimmer.
Hans Zimmer, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer.
I think it's without question.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the interesting things about Hans Zimmer for me is he always reminded me of... who's the geezer that did... who's the fella that did the Bolero?
The Bolero?
Yeah, French guy.
Andre...
No, it was...
No.
It was...
I don't know what that was.
Andre Rue did...
Maurice Ravelle. Is that
Maurice Ravelle, that's yeah. right. So, right. So one of the things that I liked about... One of the criticisms through time for, and this directly relates to Hans Zimmer, is about Bolero, was as good, as amazing a piece of music as it is, and as oft used as it is, mm-hmm. Is how fucking repetitive. It's just basically two different themes repeated over and over on different instruments. And I think that was also the beauty of Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
And he's actually... His two biggest influences, Hans Zimmer's two biggest influences were Maurice Ravel and Ennio Morricone, who did the music for, what was it called? That movie with the great music, The Mission, just some of the most beautiful film music ever. And one of the great things about Hans Zimmer from listening to a lot of his soundtracks is he just repeats themes and uses. He's semi music composer and semi soundscape, developer. And I think it's mm-hmm. incredible. I think, I mean, some of the movies that he's done that I know of would be, he did a lot of the work on Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yep.
He did the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the Da Vinci Code has a really beautiful theme. But again, mm-hmm. it's repetitive. If you like it's the main theme, mm-hmm. and it just keeps going up in key, and it's just three notes repeated, but it's beautifully done, and there's like beautiful choral music behind it, and it's incredible. But again, very simple. It's not like John Williams is very romantic and intricate yes. and musical, but Hans Zimmer is very. He knows what he's writing for. He's writing. For a movie, and it's really odd listening to a Hans Zimmer soundtrack on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But actually watching it in a movie, it just makes a whole lot of difference. And of course, he does all of the Christopher Nolan stuff.
Dude, I mean, I'm looking at his list here. Gladiator, uh-huh. The Lion King.
I didn't even realize.
Yeah. I didn't know it all these years, and mm-hmm. man, I can't tell you, like my generation, like.
True Romance.
That Incredible. True Romance? I never saw that.
Mm-hmm. True Romance he's done. He's done a lot of animated movies.
Yes, he has, yes. He did. Where is it? I just saw Prince of Egypt, Madagascar, Rango.
Interestingly enough, I'm seeing him here as being the composer for the score of The Simpsons movie and not Danny Elfman. I wonder why that is. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Who's now automatically number three, right? I mean, if Hans Zimmer is number two. But I mean, just talking about his work in the Christopher Nolan stuff, three of his Christopher Nolan soundtracks are, and I'm going to talk about the most genius one last. You've got Inception.
Yep.
And he just, he's one of these composers that is completely influenced by the work he's composing for.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he's got this piece in Inception, and if you want to look it up, it's called Time.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm going to play a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Time by, who's it, but do you know it's by
Hans Zimmer?
Oh, he wrote the song?
He wrote Time. Yeah, it's, so basically it's a part of the soundtrack of Inception.
All right, let's see.
But it's so quiet. You can almost barely hear it at the start.
Yeah, let's see if you can share audio. Let's see.
Yeah, it's come up on like.
Hear it?
Yeah, it's four notes. The whole thing is four notes. If you listen to this, like if we just take like a minute to just listen to this the whole way through, it's four notes the entire way. Four root notes, and then there's like a riff on top at the end. Johnny Marr playing guitars. He uses the horns to bring the dynamic out.
Wow, man.
pretty incredible, right?
Yeah, man. Wow.
It's incredible.
He just takes you to, you know, what I love about composers like that is they, and it's interesting. I wonder how much are they? I don't need to see that movie to feel the feelings of that movie.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, right? Like, it's so specific, though, that movie, right? It's like about fucking in limbo dreaming and all that shit, but it also is just really about love.
Yeah.
You know, and that guy took you to an, he started you at a volume, at a dynamic that you're like, holy shit, we're at like pianissimo, right?
Yeah.
And he takes you to such a loud dynamic that you didn't think, and it's not even loud, it's just rich.
It's rich, and it's this is where the Ravel comparison comes in, is if you listen to Bolero.
That's right.
The different instruments that are introduced. I mean, you listen to the genius of Bolero, just to get sidetracked for a minute. I mean, people talk about the rich A riff, A-A-M melody, and then this kind of jazzy atonal B melody. That's great, but the genius of Bolero is the snare drum.
Yes.
The dynamic of the snare drum and how precise. It sounds simple. It's just a simple kind of marching beat. Mm-hmm. But the precision of the dynamic increasing,
the precision of the dynamic changing is, you know, if you listen to Bolero and you go, okay,
it sounds really simple, but that snare drum is just increasing in dynamic.
And I think he does that. Hans Zimmer does that very well. He uses the instruments to increase the dynamic. Not necessarily. I mean, there's definitely a sense of the instruments being hit harder. But it really is just using the orchestra as an instrument. And also, I don't know if you heard me say during the track that we played, he uses Johnny Marr for all his guitar work.
Who's that? I heard you say Johnny something.
He's the guitar player from the Smiths.
Johnny, how do you spell that?
Johnny Marr. Oh God.
Oh, I got him.
I want to say.
Got him right here.
M-A-H-E-R, is that it? M-A-R-R. How do you spell Johnny? M-A-R-R, I think.
Yeah, I got him right here, yep.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He does the guitar work for that, and did the guitar work for, which is the next, you know, because Hans Zimmer is a top three for me. The next one was, that I was going to talk about, was The Dark Knight.
Real fast, before we do that, there is something that blew me away with Inception's soundtrack. Do you know about, there's this German piece of music or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to find it, right? But here it is. Check this shit out. Oh my God, this is amazing. So, what am I doing?
You've just shared the screen.
Did you see
luckily you weren't watching some pornography before we started.
You just saw my
was that your grandma?
My diary. This out. So there's this Edith. It's a French. I'm sorry. It's French, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, listen to this.
Oh. Edith Piaf.
Okay, so here's what happens with that.
Mm-hmm.
What's that called now?
Edith Piaf.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an Easter egg, you know.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know that's an Easter egg in the movie.
I'm trying to find the video. Here it is. Here is the video.
That's the part of the start, right?
That's so... Oh, that is so cool, man. Dude, it gives me chills. So that's if anybody... Good. Look, for whoever just listened to that and doesn't know what the fuck they just heard...
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so funny, man. We got to even explain Inception if I'm going to explain this. But the concept, and this is what I think what you started talking about with Hans Zimmer, is he gets, he not only just creates feelings for what he sees in the movie and in the script, but like even conceptualizes like the sci-fi nature of Inception, of going into lucid dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And there are levels of dreaming mm-hmm. until you're in limbo, for instance. And what he did was, I guess they played that Edith Piaf piece in the movie. And the whole idea was that when I it's wild how he thought of it, but when you slow down, you know, four times whatever the speed.
Sure.
Right. And that's bah, bah, bah. Mm-hmm. And it sounds evil. It sounds fucking like, mm-hmm. and he just recreated that with mm-hmm. by writing it for an orchestra. And yeah. that was the concept. I mean,
and plus you add to that the concept of the movie, which is the time difference between the dream levels.
Yes.
So how you would hear, how you would hear that song. If you were at a level down, would be like that. Uh-huh. So he's basically giving you an idea of what it would sound like to the characters in that level of the dream.
Yes.
Compared to what it would actually sound like. And also an interesting Easter egg for that particular movie was, it was sung by Edith Piaf. And Edith Piaf's life was told in a movie called Le Vion Rose. And Edith Piaf was played by Marion Cotillard, who played Mal in Inception.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. Man. It's wild.
Wild, dude.
There's so many clever things he does like that. So many clever things. And the number one is the cleverest one, but I'll get to that in a minute. Number two soundtrack for Hans is The Dark Knight. And the piece that, for me, is just the standout piece is obviously just the... And if you want to listen to it, please do. It's the audio representation of the Joker as a character.
Oh, I love it, dude. Incredible. Yes. Incredible. So simple.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But brilliant.
So as far as I can remember, it was created by two musicians, two incredible musicians. So it was Johnny Marr on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was using an Ebow for a lot of it. And for people that are not familiar what an Ebow is an electronic device that uses two magnetic poles to vibrate a guitar string over the pickup that creates a sustained single note which has undertones and overtones with it. So it creates three notes in one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very unique sound it creates. But there's that. And plus, he coupled that with the cello playing of an incredible cellist called Tina Guo, who's basically
right.
if you've seen a movie with cello in it, it's basically her playing it. She does all of the things with cello.
Mm-hmm.
And it's completely atonal. It's completely just creepy and insidious. And I wouldn't know how to explain it in theoretical musical terms, but I remember watching the movie for the first time thinking, like, this characterization is great. Heath Ledger is clearly monumental in it, but
yes.
that soundtrack creeps me right out. There you go. That's an Ebow.
It's fucking brilliant. So simple.
No, there's nothing to it. Listen to that.
And you know what's interesting?
You can hear the cello on your eighth, the bow on the cello.
Mm-hmm.
So, very interesting thing about this.
They're schemers, nothing but schemers.
Yeah. He uses this. He uses the same thing in Dunkirk.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, what it's actually called is, it's very interesting, it's called a shepherd tone.
Okay.
And have you ever heard of a shepherd tone?
No, I haven't.
Shepherd tone is very, very interesting, and I'm going to give you the definition of it right now. It's a sound consisting of a superposition of sine waves separated by octaves. When played with the bass pitch of the tone moving upward or downward, it is referred to as a shepherd scale. It creates the auditory illusion of a tone that seems to continually ascend or descend in pitch.
Oh, I know what that is, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Which ultimately gets no higher or lower. So it creates a auditory illusion that it's a continuing like scale going up or down, mm-hmm. but it's not going anywhere. It suits that character and it suits that movie. So the chaotic nature of that movie so well. It's like, again, you know, comparing it to John Williams. John Williams, very flowery, Wordsworthy, classical, you know, beauty.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer is just literally representing these fucking characters just in audio form. It's incredible. It's
unreal. And that movie in general, like, mm-hmm. I remember, and I still have the ticket stub of the first time I saw it. I mean, I was so pumped to see that movie. Incredible. And I do kind of think to this day, like, man, if Heath were still alive, that trilogy would be different. It would have panned out differently. It might have been epic, you know, like it might have been epic if he were able to do another movie.
Sure.
Oh man. But anyway, Hans Zimmer, because you know, right? I mean, so simple,
incredible. And then his number one soundtrack for me is Dunkirk, and the way that timing is used in it. He uses the clock, so he recorded a sample of Christopher Nolan's pocket watch.
Oh shit!
So each segment of there's three segments of that movie, and they're all, so the movie is done over a week for one person, a day for another person, and an hour for another person.
Wow.
So for the week, it's almost like a subliminal. For the week, it's like that, and then for the day, it's like, and then for the hour, it's, so there's like a ticking going on in the background representing the and then obviously everybody comes to the same point at the same time in the mm-hmm. in the narrative, but he represents the different lengths of somebody's narrative in real time with this ticking in the background. It's just like,
so that crazy movie I haven't seen yet. I have to see that one.
Incredible. It's so good.
Another guy that, by the way, is kind of, I'm seeing him all over the place now, is this Ludwig Göransson.
Okay.
He did Tenet.
Oh, he did Tenet? Okay.
Yeah, he did Tenet. Yeah. But if I'm correct, he also did, yeah, he did all of the soundtrack for The Mandalorian.
So good.
Yeah, so cool, man. So fucking cool. He did he did the Black Panther.
Okay.
Yeah. The dude is, and there's a video actually of his like making of the, and it just looks like he was just very simple process. I think he worked with Donald Glover. What's his artist name?
Childish Gambino.
That's right, Childish Gambino. Yeah. And I think he worked on that one. Was it the last album, Childish Gambino? Where they had that song Redbone, and you know all those great tracks, man. I think he worked on that with him.
So amazing. Good, right? So good. If he did Tenet, then Tenet's an amazing piece of art, an amazing
movie. Saw it?
I've seen Tenet, yeah. The music is fantastic in it. The soundtrack's amazing. I assumed that it was Hans Zimmer again, but I guess he moved away from Hans Zimmer and used somebody else, which is kind of cool.
It's interesting because I know you're going to tell me the same thing, like that you really can't say anything about Tenet, that I just have to see it, because that's when my one buddy was like, you have to see it, and I can't tell you anything about it.
It's very, very cool. It's a very cool movie. It's a very cool concept. It's terribly confusing.
I love it.
You know, give it a couple of watches. It's very confusing. The guy, I don't remember what his name is, the guy from Black Klansman's in it, he's great. Kenneth Branagh is amazing as a bad guy. There's a few really, really interesting... It's a very technical movie. So he's really showing off his technical filmmaking abilities in this movie, but it's phenomenal. It really is.
Okay.
It really is an incredible piece of work. It's just mind-bending how it all works. I mean, after the movie ended, I was like, I don't really know what happened, but I just know that I enjoyed it.
And that's all that matters.
That's all that matters. Yeah, yeah.
Paul, real fast, we should do we should continue this, because we haven't scratched the surface. Because I have so many tabs open of other movies to talk about, but we'll jot them. We'll just list them without talking about them. But like, sure. Back to the Future. Amazing.
Back to the Future. Danny Elfman?
Is that Danny Elfman?
Is that Danny Elfman? I don't know. Was that Danny Elfman?
Let's see. Back to the Future.
What was the big theme for Back to the Future?
Let's see. Oh man, it's in my head. Come on.
Alan Silvestri. It's Alan Silvestri, man. He's great. Alan Silvestri is superb. Alan Silvestri did Back to the Future. Alan Silvestri also wrote one of my favorite themes in any movie ever, and you're going to make fun of me for the movie.
Go ahead, I don't care.
It's called Serendipity.
Okay.
And he did this theme, which is, it's the most beautiful theme music I've ever heard in a movie, and I can never fucking find it online anywhere. There's no recording of it. Like, there's no standalone recording of this, but it's beautiful, like a little piano piece. Alan Silvestri writes a lot on piano.
Okay.
He's a very good pianist. But Back to the Future, what an amazing soundtrack that
amazing.
Was.
Amazing. Incredible. Amazing. Like you said, guy plays piano, and the first thing, one of the things about that soundtrack that get me, and I remember, because I remember being a kid, I remember it was always on, and when it was on, we would always watch it, right?
I don't think you're allowed to not watch it. I think that's
I
think it's a law. Yeah,
yeah. You have to, right?
Mm-hmm.
When he, like, for instance, when he I think when he first is travels anyway, and he's in 1955, and he starts seeing where he is by seeing, like, what the fuck sign is that? Where did the, you know, there's this like piano thing, like really high up on the high register.
Yeah.
Like this fucking, you know, yeah. And it's so like magical. And I just remember being, prior to my music knowledge, that was just a thing that was part of the movie. But if it wasn't there, it just wouldn't be as powerful of those moments.
Sure.
And you know, it's interesting the power that the director and the producer gives over to the composer.
Well, I mean, from watching behind the scenes footage of movies being made, and we get a lot more now, or at least we did when we had DVDs. I mean, the era of DVD was the ultimate era of, you found out everything of that went into a movie, because they filled out multi-disc sets with behind the scenes footage. And I always got the sense that these composers were just seen as luminaries on like on these movies. It was like you could see the director like bowing and kneeling down, saying, here you go, composer, here's my movie, please.
For real.
Sprinkle your fairy dust on it. I mean, one in particular that I just gorged on at the time was the Lord of the Rings.
There
was so much. When you bought the extended version on DVD, you got like 8 discs of extras. And
that's right.
Just there was an entire hour-long documentary on the music, and the soundtrack was created by Howard Shore.
Shore.
Who's an amazing composer as well, incredible composer.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way that it was just like, there's like Peter Jackson sitting in the studio, and like Peter Jackson is an involved guy. Like he's a hands-on guy with filmmaking. I mean, he's a film school guy still, you know, like he always says he makes very expensive film school films, you know. And he's just like, you know, he's in Abbey Road and he's just like just letting Howard Shore do his thing. And it's just incredible to see, you know, Howard Shore with his, and Howard Shore is like a, I would say he would be on the older side of composers. He wouldn't be one of these young guys, like, you know.
His music was very, compared to John Williams, very romantic.
Yeah, and very, Howard Shore does a far more, a far wider range of films, I find. Like, John For Williams,
drama, right?
Yeah,
drama.
He does a lot of drama, he does a lot of like understated stuff, but thematically, with The Lord of the Rings, there was one of the amazing things about Howard Shore's input in Lord of the Rings is, You have the soundtrack, the themes. There's so many of them. I mean, I could rattle off 3 or 4 of them right now.
Bum, 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 bum. Right.
Yeah,
the orcs theme,
yeah, and the Fellowship theme is amazing, and you know. And the Hobbits theme.
That one, right? Or is that the Hobbit theme?
The Hobbit theme is din din din.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It's very cool. But the ultimate theme, and I can never remember this. It's the Gondor theme, and it's very Hans Zimmer. It's climbing. It's like something that it's repetitive in climbing. It's kind of Zimmer-esque, but and then you have the theme of the Rohirrim, which was played on a Norwegian violin.
Yes.
So it's played on
Norwegian
violin, which is a violin that's, it's almost like a viola. It's like a, it's a bigger, deeper instrument, but it's so, it's like just a solo violin. It's so beautiful. So he had that. He also had the 3 theme songs that were sung respectively by Enya for the first movie.
Oh yeah.
Emiliana Torini for the second movie.
Annie Lennox
for the third movie. So
yeah,
he co-wrote all of those songs, but then he also had, if you watch the extended editions, and there's some in the movies,
mm-hmm.
but there's songs within the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the you know, there's the song that there's a song that in the extended edition that Eowyn sings at a funeral, which is beautiful. And then
I remember that.
You know, Aragorn's song, which actually, oddly, it's the one he sings at the end. It's like, Eterello,
Eterello.
It's so beautiful. But he wrote all of that as well. He wrote all of the songs within the movie. He co-wrote that with Viggo Mortensen. Himself and Viggo Mortensen sat down and co-wrote that thing on. You know, I feel like Aragorn should sing to the hobbits or sing to the people, and he co-wrote this just using the mythology and the words and the elvish or whatever he was. So just the amount of elements that was that were created, and it all nearly never happened, because there's a very funny story with the Lord of the Rings soundtrack. So it's hilarious. So they recorded the audio, the soundtrack in Abbey Road, but they also edited the audio. So they had all the Foley, they had all the live audio, they had all of the computerized created audio, and then they put it all together in Abbey Road. And this is just, you're talking about Peter Jackson being a film school guy. the audio was put on a thumb drive.
Okay?
A thumb drive, okay? And there was, the editing suite for the movie was across town.
Okay.
It was in London, across town. So this low-level Abbey Road employee was entrusted with, okay, here's the thumb drive, here's the audio for the Fellowship of the Ring movie. All of it. It's all on this. This is the master file. You need to get this to the editing suite across town. I think it was in like Tottenham or something. So Abbey Road, St. John's Wood, Tottenham, like, it's quite a ways in London. It's like a few, definitely a few subway rides.
Okay.
So he, this guy leaves the studio and he's walking down Abbey Road, walking down into St. John's Wood to get the tube. And there's like these roughs, these like thugs are behind him, like following him. And he's like, shit.
Oh, shit.
He's like, shit, I've got, and he's like looking at them and he's getting freaked out and he runs and these two guys just run after him. And the only thing he's thinking about is he's not thinking about getting mugged or getting beat up or anything. He's thinking, I cannot let them steal this thumb drive. So it nearly, the actual guy who was given the job of getting it, he got it there eventually. He managed to escape these guys. But that, all that music was nearly, I mean, I'm sure they had it on backup, so it's pretty romanticized, but yeah, he was like chased and nearly mugged and he had the music and all the sound elements for the movie in his pocket.
Oh my God. Like,
how freaked out would you be by that?
Dude, I would be, dude, I would like be in the shower and just, you'd hear me go, like I'm just reliving that stress, you know, like Bill Burr, the comedian, he says, he's like, every once in a while, my wife will hear me, I'll be in the shower and she'll just hear me go, because he's just thinking about like a time that he bombed really bad,
really bad
as a young comic, and it just never leaves him. So,
yeah, I mean,
we all have our moments, right?
We all have that. I mean, it's it, and they always seem to, just as you finish reading a couple of pages of your book, it's like a Friday night, you're looking forward to a nice cozy night's sleep, a nice lie-in in the morning, you're going to have like some beautiful coffee and a nice, slow, quiet morning. And just as you're about to fall asleep, you remember that time that you like wet yourself, or you know, or like you just said the stupidest thing ever, and then that's it. 3:30 in the morning, you're still awake, agonizing about it. that's probably what that moment was like. But great soundtrack, great composer, and
created a world.
Yeah, I mean, you know? And like a lot of people say, I mean, it's you know, the subject matter, it's so easy to create, but just to do it in such an amazing way, using like, you know, he had like James Galway play like flute,
sure,
you know, or whistle or whatever. I mean, James Galway is the preeminent guy, but just the illusions, the visuals that he created with the audio tools that he was given, just, it's mind-blowing. Listening to it, it's just absolutely mind-blowing.
Obviously, there are plenty of people who love the books way more than the movies, and what, you know, for whatever the fuck their reasons are, I don't really give a shit. But however, for them, I imagine that reading the books, and you know, a segment in the book where they're going into the Shire, and having that theme in your head, right, or the Gondor theme, like you said, or. Like even certain scenes, you know, there's music from certain scenes in the movie that I can remember, and that must be cool to like specific to that legendary series of books, right? Like where it existed long before the movies, and people, there were, you know, fans of it long before the movies. It's almost like I would hope that people who enjoyed, I would hope that the people who like the books more, who will read it now and again. I hope that the soundtrack helped make that experience better.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually read the books on a few occasions since I've seen the movies, and I used to read the book more regularly. I was on the Christopher Lee timetable of reading Lord of the Rings, which is once every year. he used to read the books once every year. I used to do the same thing.
Wow.
But So 2 months, 2 months out of every year was, that was my book that I read. But so I knew it inside out, and I have read it a few times since. And definitely it's definitely helps me create more so the music than the visuals. Actually, I can still, like, I had a very set image of what I thought these places and these characters look like before I saw the movies. The movies, I mean, every movie adaptation of a book is going to, it's going to elevate certain things, and it's going to disappoint in other ways. There's no two ways about it. But I can ignore the visual stuff I didn't like, but that music is insidious in the best possible way. It's so, it really stays with me. I'm kind of playing the soundtrack, and especially the more identifiable stuff, like the Rohirrim music is just, every time I read that part of the book, you know, where they're like waking Theoden up from his stupor, I'm playing it in the background of my head, you know. It's incredible. It's so
amazing.
Cool.
And those movies are, I would say that you can't say you like, how about this? If you like Game of Thrones, but you never watched Lord of the Rings, those people exist, by the way, which I baffles me, because there are people that I know that would have, nah, I'm not watching, I'm not into that, Lord of the Rings, nah, I'm not into that, but they got into Game of Thrones.
Because they're dirty bastards.
they needed the sex and
the
violence.
They needed the sex and the violence, yeah.
But I would say that the Lord of the Rings broke ground for that type of, yeah, for that type of, you create a world.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it has an enormous legacy. The book had as well, but it made fantasy cool again.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the last cool fantasy movie was probably Willow before that.
I never saw that.
Which was like hugely Tolkien influenced, but I mean, before that, maybe Conan.
Okay.
So that's sparse. Like Conan is late 70s, the first one, maybe early 80s for the second one. Willow was definitely late 80s at the, you know, maybe even mid 80s. And then nothing.
Yeah, really.
Apart from maybe a few animated things like The Dark Crystal, or, you know.
Maybe Robin Hood, the Kevin Costner, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's more historical.
Is it really?
It's not even really fantasy. It was, yeah, I guess, like, so. You're talking about like elves and dwarves and shit.
Oh, gotcha.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking like medieval shit. I don't know why.
Yeah, yeah. So so the legacy of The Lord of the Rings is, okay, you would not have had the Dungeons and Dragons movie. You would not have had, I don't think they would have made Game of Thrones if it hadn't been for Lord of the Rings.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. That, and we could talk about that music maybe on the next one, because I think Game of Thrones has a cool soundtrack, distinct to itself. It kind of gets you in the mood too, especially if you hear that one string instrument, which I don't know what it is, but yeah, I'll be like, ooh, let's fucking watch some Game of Thrones. Let's watch some.
Yeah, the weird thing about Game of Thrones, maybe we should do like a half an episode just for Game of Thrones. Yeah, but
just for the music?
Just for the music of Game of Thrones. Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, because there is, again, you have a very similar thing to Lord of the Rings. You have the music, and then you have the audio.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have, like, thematically, it's very different. Like, one of the amazing things about Game of Thrones is the sound that they created for when the dragons breathe fire, that... It's like,
oh, I never even picked up on that.
It's like a guitar. It's like somebody like just sliding down a distorted guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Every time the dragon breathes fire, it makes that sound. It's incredible.
Wow, I never picked up on that, man.
But
and you know why? Do you know why? I think, by the way, too, is like an idiot. I remember back in the day, watching it, like, you know, like finding some site where it's really bad quality. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have an HBO or whatever.
Of course, because nobody wanted to pay for that shit, right?
Yeah.
Because it was the only thing on there as well. I mean, there was that. And I mean, I'm sure you watched Louie, which was on there, but it was the only thing.
No, Louie wasn't on. Louie was on FX.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but you are right. There really wasn't that much on.
Not much.
On HBO, yeah.
Not much of anything, but okay. So let's just switch gears here a little bit.
Sure.
For the next portion. So I mentioned at the top of the episode that there's music that's composed for the movies, but then there's songs that are used in like other music that's used in movies. So I'm talking about movies
exactly
like
what you're talking about,
like High Fidelity, like movies like that. What have you got? What are your greatest hits with that stuff?
Oh man, I mean like, it's Power of Love, right? Like you can't.
I'm already
go
rocking out to it. Yeah.
Money, don't take fame. Yeah, I love that. I fucking love that. That's the one that sticks out to me the most so far. I'm trying to think. Oh, we were talking about when we were hanging out last week. With Kat and Mitch, remember we watched that scene from the original Batman movie with Jack Nicholson and that Prince song? Oh my god, dude.
That semi qualifies because it was actually written for the movie, but it's a great pop tune for.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess on its own, it could be a song. How about that?
It's great. You know what the great thing about that song? And it's not on the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look up the soundtrack, it's not on there either.
Uh-huh.
I gotta just check into my. Gotta put my password back in here. So that I can keep an eye on my recording here. That's why my eyes keep going to the thing.
That was a nice little view there.
Of my crotch, yeah. Crotch view. Luckily, I have pants on today. So there's a great part in that song. So if you watch the YouTube video of Party Man, the music video is incredible. It's like a typical Prince.
Yeah. You know?
But there's a amazing saxophone solo in it. Amazing saxophone solo. It's not in the Spotify version of it. It's not in the movie version of it. But for the music video, it's an extended version of the song. Listen, look it up on YouTube. It's the only place I found it. And I know that there's been a mining of Prince material off of YouTube recently.
Oh, yeah.
So it may not even be there anymore. But there's a great, groovy saxophone solo. It's very 80s, but it's played by amazing female saxophone player. I can't remember her name for the life of me, but
I see the video right here.
Candice something, yeah. And it's really good. It's really, really very cool. And the actual saxophonist that.
Oh my god! In the video, he has Prince has half his face is like the Joker.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing, dude.
Yeah, it's really good. The music video is very cool,
dude. Even at the end of the movie when he had that parade, do you remember? And there was also. There was also a Prince song.
It's called Bat Dance. Bat Dance. So it used, and the interesting thing about it is that, you know, so you have obviously Danny Elfman's music.
That has a music video too.
What, Bat Dance?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the crazy thing about it is, and I didn't realize this till later on, is that he uses, remember the 60s TV show with Adam West?
Yeah, of course.
Batman. He uses that same thing. Batman. He uses that in Bat Dance. Bat Dance.
Oh shit!
That's what it is. It's the same theme. So it's like
he kind of
keeps it thematically through it. Yeah, but it's a very similar beat to Party Man. But you know, obviously he obviously was keeping repeating themes. But I think he did Vicky Vale's theme, which is beautiful. It's piano, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, incredible, incredible. That's actually a really cool call because we were listening to it last week thinking, and remember Rich telling us he hated the song.
Oh, that's right.
And
that's right.
I think it's great.
I love it. We were dying laughing. Just, it's the Joker. He just gassed a bunch of people in that museum/restaurant, which was kind of weird, by the way. Yeah. And they're dead, but he left that mask. Mm-hmm. Oxygen mask or whatever for Vicky Vale, so he can like come in, destroy all of the art, right? Dance around like an idiot, right? And then sit down and have dinner with her.
I mean
it's just when you think about that scene, I remember being a kid. I remember being like 4 or 5 years old watching this movie, man. My parents let me watch it, and things like that didn't register the psychotic nature of it. I just thought, this guy's fun.
He's fun. He's a cool guy, right?
And those guys, those people went to sleep. Look, they're smiling, you know?
Yeah, they're smiling. Yeah, it's nice. It's not creepy at all. And it was great. hang on a minute, I like this one.
Oh, that's right.
Like really dark one with the guy stabbing something. Like, I like this one. Yeah,
dude,
so,
I love it.
So cool. Very, very cool. Very, very of its time as well. Like, very, we're moving from the 80s into the 90s.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I remember telling you last week when we were hanging, I watched that. I went 9 times to the movie theater to watch that movie. I mean, I was
amazing.
I was all about Batman. I was all about Michael Keaton as Batman. I thought he was great.
Yeah,
he's
was
had
good.
His detractors. He's great. He's going to be in the next Batman movie.
That's right.
Which
oh, wait, hold on. No, I'm sorry.
The one after the next one. He's going to be in the Flash movie.
The Flash. That's the one. Yes.
Yeah, he's going to be in the Flash movie,
I think that's so cool.
Well, what I like about it is, I think it's encouraging because, just getting off the music thing for a minute, the fact he's going to be in that movie is it's clearly going to be a multiverse thing.
Yes.
So that's going to be, so that introduces all sorts of possibilities for for that to happen.
But whatever is left of DC.
Whatever is left of DC. Well, I mean, I think maybe Zack Snyder just saved DC with his version of
I didn't see Justice it. Thing.
It's way too long. But terribly Zack Snyder. One of the things that I didn't like about it, I sat down to watch it, and he uses the old aspect ratio. So it's not widescreen or anything. And it was and you can't change it. You can't change it because it's like, and then the message that comes up is like, how eye-rolly is this? You are not allowed to change the aspect ratio of this movie. The reason we have done this is to keep Zack's original vision in mind. I'm like, oh, fucking snooze. If I go to see a fucking Christopher Nolan movie, he doesn't make me watch it in IMAX. He doesn't go, no, if you don't have IMAX on your TV, you cannot. Like, it's such a douchey thing. But I'm a huge Zack Snyder fan. I love everything he's done. I love. I mean, I don't understand why people don't like his movies. I just don't. I think I can sit down and watch a 3-hour movie, no problem. Some people can't. But I'm a fan. But I was just like, please, you know, just make the fucking movie to fit my TV screen, will you?
Yeah, yeah, for real.
But I loved it. But so going back to songs in movies.
Yeah, what's yours?
Mine is a little bit unusual. Mine is the theme. It's been appropriated. Now people think that this was written for the film, but it wasn't. It's the part of the piano part from Tubular Bells in The Exorcist.
I you know what? Never seen it.
Do 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 do.
I know that though.
Do 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 do. Lots of people. I mean, people are always surprised to hear. They're like, "No, that was written for that movie. It was not written for that movie. It was used in the movie as part of the soundtrack, but it was not written for The Exorcist."
Wow.
And that's my one. I mean, like you're talking about. I mean, it could have been written for the movie. It's so perfect. It's so perfect for it. But.
It's so, I mean, it makes, I never saw the movie, but I know it. You know what I mean? I know that theme.
Yeah.
That's how powerful that is.
It's incredible. It's such an incredible piece of music that just, even though it was written completely independent of that movie, it was perfect for it. And just the right amount of creepy. It's also very beautiful and it's used sparsely in it, but pretty incredible. And then also you've got, I mean, we didn't really have this movie in Europe, but that Simple Minds song from The Breakfast Club.
Oh God, yeah.
Don't
That's right.
you forget about me. Crazy. It's crazy how it's just like that and the one that you mentioned, which was from, what was the one you said?
Oh, Power of Love from
Power
Back to
of
the
Love
Future.
From Back to the Future and St. Elmo's Fire as well. I believe St. Elmo's Fire was written for that, but so that's not really qualified. But
okay,
but yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of great.
Oh man, I remember Home Alone, and I remember there's a scene where he goes to the supermarket by himself. Mm-hmm. I think, or no, or something. He's doing shit, and then I remember this. No, this is what happened. He's doing his. He put the shit on his face, you remember? And it burned. And he went, ah! You know, but it's do 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 do. Right.
I've been dreaming of a why.
Now, if you keep listening to that song, mm-hmm. right? There's like a like the next.
I guess it's the.
It's amazing.
It's the Drifters.
It's the Drifters,
version,
yeah.
It's yeah, the Drifters, it's the yeah. Drifters version, which is, yeah. I think, the best version of that song.
Yes.
Even though I'm not a huge fan of Christmas music, I think that's pretty much one of the better ones. And what was the other one I was
rocking
thinking?
Rocking around the Christmas tree. That's another good one.
There was another one I was thinking of, another great song that was very much like part of the movie. Oh, fuck, I can't remember for the life.
Oh, Home Alone, you mean?
No, it was a different movie, but it was a song in the movie that was just
Risky Business, right?
Risky Business, yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Very, very yeah. I love that. I love when those two art forms meet. I mean, I didn't like the movie, I did not like the song, but the two joined together, you know, it's pretty cool.
I mean, you know what, dude? This is what's great. It's like movies can make music good too. Mm-hmm. So like the way that music made, like, real fast, just to swing back to Star Wars, when they were filming that, those mm-hmm. actors, especially Alec Guinness, who played Ben Kenobi, dude, they were like, what the fuck is this shit? What the this fuck is a Wookiee? They're walking around like, yeah. you know what I mean? They had no yeah. idea. They thought it was a joke. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and most of them, like Luke and Leia, were young actors. So it's like they were just happy to be
working
in a film. But they're thinking like, yeah, but this is like, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah.
And Alec Guinness, of course, was like a theater actor. So to yeah. him, this is bullshit. When they saw the movie, though, they were like, oh my God. And yeah. I actually think the music was 50% of that delivery of that story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think I remember watching a documentary of the original Star Wars movie mm-hmm. Where they were, like, the movie was edited, all the visuals were done, the script was done. The movie was complete and it was still complete garbage. And then they watched it with the film, the music behind it, and the studio. I think there was literally a day where the studio guys, the guys that had paid for it or whatever, said, "All right, let's watch this movie now with the music." And they were like, "Different movie. It's great. We love it."
Yeah, amazing.
It's amazing.
Did you know, by the way, little tidbit? Did you know that, like, and I could try to look up how old he was, but did you know that during the filming of A New Hope, that was the first one, right? Mm-hmm. George Lucas had a heart attack. Like a bad heart attack. And they had to like stop. And it was a thing of like they had to keep asking for longer production time, more money. Like, it stressed him out. He almost died basically making that movie.
It's crazy.
Guy,
man.
You know, it's crazy.
It's crazy. But I mean, what a legacy. I mean, it's the king of movies.
Yeah.
I mean, Star Wars is, I mean, you look at, you put together, and people try to get all fucking airy fairy and artsy fartsy about movies. Like, what's your favorite movie? Oh, you know what? You know, I do it. I'm like, oh, Lincoln is my favorite movie now. And it is. It's my favorite movie. But fucking Star Wars is still a great movie.
Oh, yeah. And if it's on.
Yeah.
You know. So this concept of, like, obviously film, music makes film better. But I do think film could make songs amazing.
Yeah.
Even if you don't like the song. Mm-hmm. So here's, like, I just thought of one. Let me pick another one. And it's not that I don't like this song. It's just not, I'm not going to put on Phil Collins, but to listen to that much ever. But right. like The Hangover. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I can feel it coming in with Mike Tyson.
Sure, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, amazing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, here's one. Here's the one I thought of. Now, I was a Rush fan when I was a teenager. As I matured, I just didn't connect. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about this.
Yeah.
I didn't connect to it as much, right? Great music, though.
I can completely understand you not connecting to Rush 100%. That's all I'm going to say about
it. Emotionally, I didn't connect.
Yes.
But that movie, I Love You, Man,
mm-hmm.
you know, they made Rush cool. You know, like, do you remember, like...
I don't think I've watched the movie I Love You, Man. Is that Paul Rudd?
Yeah, you gotta see it. It's great, yeah, man. It's
I don't think
great.
I've watched a movie. There was another one I was going to say that was... There was something else. Oh, actually, interestingly, just going back to the movie Dune that I watched, the movie was actually... The music was done by Toto for that.
For real?
Just a little bit of... Yeah, a little bit of interesting...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a trivia for you, but... I don't remember what you were saying, but what you said a minute ago triggered something in me, and I cannot remember what it was for the life
making,
of me.
Movies making songs cool. Basically,
okay. We talked about this on another episode briefly, but I agree with that in most cases, but the converse is also true. And sure, the greatest example of it for me, and you might be able to come up with an example while I'm talking about this, is The Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a wonderful song.
Yeah.
It's actually a very, very good song, ruined by how it's used in a movie. Because it's used for the montage scene in a Rocky movie where he's preparing, yeah, and like the only thing I think about when I think about Eye of the Tiger now is fucking Carl Weathers and Sylvester Stallone homoerotically hugging on a beach, you know, because in like tiny shorts, and but if you
nice
listen
image.
To the, if it's a great image, yeah, but if you listen to the song itself as a standalone song, it's fucking brilliant. It's a brilliant
song.
Oh,
yeah.
The piano chords are beautiful. The guitar is wonderful. The drum beat. Dun, dun, dun. It's like...
That it's came out, great. Though, in a time when they didn't... This was... I mean, that came out right before music videos hit. Like, they were music videos, mm-hmm, but they weren't, like, productions. Mm-hmm. So go watch that music video, mm-hmm, and immediately you'll go, you know what, that band needed that movie, because those guys did not, like,
it's terrible,
they didn't know how to perform,
meaning
they didn't look the music, yeah. The music is absolutely great, the singer great, mm-hmm, but you watch him, mm-hmm, you're like, oh, Buzz, your girlfriend, woof, you know. Yeah. But no,
we should do an episode on music videos next, I think.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
That's
that
a good
will be
one.
A good one. We'll do our
you
like,
know what's
top
funny
10.
Though? If it's prior to 2010, if it's after 2010, I probably won't know it.
I have not seen a single music video, I don't think, after 2010.
Yeah.
I think the only way I would have watched a music video after 2010 would be if I'm learning a song for a gig and I don't have it on Spotify, like if it was, you know, pre-Spotify Taylor Swift for a wedding or something.
Yeah,
I would probably,
that's right.
You know.
I remember those days. Oh,
but
my God.
Yeah. But we should definitely do that. But I can't think of another, actually there's one more, which is kind of topical really, cause it's about somebody that we're going to have in the, on the podcast soon. There's a movie called My Sister's Keeper.
Okay.
Cameron Diaz. It appeals to a particular audience, but it's based on a Judy Picoult book, about a sister who's basically saving her sister's, her other sister's life or something like that. And she's, one of them's dying of cancer. But our next guest, Edwina Hayes, had a song on it called Feels Like Home, which is a cover of a Randy Newman song. I think I got the name right. Randy Newman, right? That's the guy. That's the music.
You got a friend.
That's right,
in
yeah.
Me.
So he wrote it. If you listen to the song, you'd be like, that's Randy Newman.
Wow.
She did a cover of a Randy Newman song called Feels Like Home, and it was a song that was in a movie that's just immediately identifiable. It's like it's Google identifiable. So you put in Feels Like Home and it comes up, Feels Like Home, My Sister's Keeper. It's wonderful. It's used beautifully in the movie, and it's a bit of a weepy one, but very, very cool. And Edwina, who sang it, is going to be on the podcast next week.
Awesome.
Yeah, she's
awesome,
she's great.
Looking forward to that.
That's another really significant, you know, a song where the movie helped the song and the song helped the movie. That's kind of what you mean, right? It's like,
yeah, the
symbiotic, the symbiosis of.
Oh my god!
You know,
oh my god! You just reminded me of. We could talk about this. I have a whole bunch of podcast topics that we're gonna. I have a list of things, but we'll do a part two of films. There's just too many. I think a great. You're gonna love that. You. I know you. You got me into this guy. You're gonna love this one. Once.
Yes.
We have to talk about Glenn Hansard.
Mm-hmm.
So. If you want a really good, moving, the perfect blend of music and narrative, because it's also a musical, right? And it's about a musician, and it's just the perfect encapsulation of those two things. You got to go watch Once.
I agree. I'm not saying that. I'm not biased here because it's an Irish movie. Maybe I am a little bit, but the interesting thing about watching Once for me the first time was, and I didn't watch it it was out 3 or 4 years by the time I got around to watching it, and I was like, Jesus, I should really watch this movie, is that I knew of Glenn Hansard from a very young age. I mean, he was in a very, very, very famous band in Ireland through the 90s called The Frames. Excellent band, good rock band, you know. There was a very kind of Irish. I'm going to give you the crotch view again. I got to unlock my computer again. Sorry, but there was a very set genre of Irish rock in the 90s. That they were a huge part of that movement, and a great songwriter. But then he obviously starred in this movie with Marquetta, and. They really did a good job, I think, of number one, communicating the awkwardness of like meeting somebody and, you know, kind of developing feelings for them. And, you know, it's super kind of awkward. And like he meets her kid and her friends and all that.
That's
and
right.
Then also the kind of, and then conversely for her meeting his friends when he brings her to like the session that he has,
right.
You know, and it's very well encapsulated and just very authentic. That's one of the things
that fucking song chokes me up.
Yeah. Falling slowly. Beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, beautiful. And the way that they did it in the movie was they were just in a music. Well, first of all, they open with him as a busker on the street with his guitar case open.
Sure.
Right.
People getting robbed by some junkie.
Dude, but he
dropped by a junkie, right?
He did, but that performance though, and that was the performance.
Yeah, it was.
Performance.
Yeah.
He was like, he was singing with everything he got, everything he had, man. At that moment, loud, just really strumming the fuck out of that guitar. Powerful. Hooked me. And then that when she, because that's where he met her, and then didn't they walk or something or whatever, they met at a music shop.
Yeah,
he started playing a song, which was that song, and then she just sat down on a piano
and started playing with.
And just
with
started him. Playing. He started. He started singing. Right, the next pass of that. She starts harmonizing and they just started playing together. I mean, like, obviously he gave her music. I think he wrote down something for her to read, but
correct. Yeah.
That was a perfect, beautiful musician to musician moment. And then
absolutely.
Obviously with romance in between it.
For
I mean,
sure.
I don't know. Single guy talking here. That's like a dream.
Yeah.
Scenario right there, like to have such a connection with through the thing you love the most, and then through that you meet the person you love the most. I mean, that amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very kind of you can see immediately when they meet the chemistry that they had as characters and then also as actors, yeah, superb. Just like, and just that scene actually in the music shop, because, dude, that's what we did when we were. I mean, I feel like the only thing that the movie got wrong is the age of the characters. I think if the characters had been a little bit younger, it would have been a monumental classic. I mean,
sure.
Like Glenn was well into his 30s by the time that movie came out, and was like, oh, you're a little old. Yeah. And I mean, it was kind of weird.
It was
cool. And it was cool that it was, that they played off it being like, he had committed himself to his art to the degree where he had sacrificed his own kind of almost well being to be, you know, who he was. But that scene in the music, like, that's what we did when we were kids. We went to guitar shops and picked up guitars and played. And like, there was, I think there's a bit even in the movie where the guy that owns the fucking shop is like,
oh yeah,
why are they singing in there? Like, it's weird. But it's interesting that, I mean, I guess they didn't really understand this at the time of creating the movie, but it's and I don't know who's listening if they've seen the movie, but it's right at the top of the movie. It's in the first 15 minutes, you know? Yep. And it sets off this, it just creates, like, there's the initial performance of him busking, which is wonderful, but it just sets off this cascade of, like, beautiful communication between two artists on a level that I wish everyone could understand at some stage in their life, you know? Just connecting with somebody in such just a different level, and you can see it on screen happening. Like, you can see them, these two characters, falling in love with each other through this medium. You know, it's great.
And you know what? If you want to just like get into Glenn Hansard himself, I listened to him talk to Pete Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the best podcasts I've ever listened to. I mean, he is such a great storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
He's got great experiences and stories to tell.
Sure.
He's an incredible, he seems like an incredibly generously nice, humble dude. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by the podcast. Just, this is just a guy. He's like, at base level, yes, I have a career as a famous musician, but I'm just a guy who's busking still, like, in a just, people are actually coming to see me do it, and it's in a theater kind of thing. Like,
sure.
You know, it's very, very cool. He's very happy, you know, very like happy to be just playing music. And that,
yeah,
you know.
He's spearheaded a lot of very good movements in Ireland. He's obviously very much involved in the development of young artists. Not in a Ryan Adams way, in a kind of honest and good way. But he's also a bit of an activist, and he does a lot of, we've got a very large homelessness problem in Ireland right now, and he does a lot of work for making sure those people are housed and, you know, bringing, like, really using his art, not as some sort of service to it, like lip service to fans. Look, I'm a good person. Like, he sacrifices his time, and he gives up his time to help people. And there's an authenticity, like, the way that he lives his life is very authentic, and his music and his art reflects that authenticity. And I actually met him at Dublin Airport one time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I bumped into him at Dublin Airport. I was like, and he lives on a farm, and he was disgusting in like a tweed coat and fucking shit covered boots, and he was getting in a fucking, you know, those farm Land Rovers in Britain, you know, or in Ireland, they're like little rickety things. And he was picking some people up from the airport, and I was like, Glenn, like being an asshole, what up, Glenn? You know, and he's like, waves, cool. You know, he's a very, very, very cool, down to earth guy. But I feel like, just to kind of plug my country here, I feel like, you know, artists in Ireland, what it is you're not allowed to get too carried away with yourself, you know, by the populace.
Bono.
You know? I mean, the thing about it is that, the interesting thing about Bono is that you would say that, but in Ireland, Bono is like, people just don't care. You know what I mean? People don't care. They just literally, like, they still live in the houses that they bought when they had their big hits, and they still go shopping in the village, and people still, everyone in Dublin has a Bono or Edge story.
You know? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So when they're at home, it's very, you're very, one of the unique things about Ireland is, no matter how famous you get, when you're in Ireland, you're just, the person that you are. You're appreciated for your art, but you know, you're not treated like celebrities are here. You know, you don't get any preferential treatment.
It's ridiculous here, man. It's stupid.
Yeah, it's stupid. Yeah, it's so dumb. It's really dumb.
By the way, I don't want to sound like I'm dissing U2. I love U2. I grew up listening to them. Big U2 fan. All right. Well, anyway,
you're already a bigger U2 fan than I am. No, I mean, I appreciate what they've done for. I think we were on another podcast with Gooch. Remember when I was like, oh, fucking U2.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's kind of like that might be a little bit of me being. It's very bourgeois to be a U2 fan if you're from Ireland, to be basically. But I understand.
You know what though? It's a musician thing too, man. And you're not the only one. I always come into contact with musicians who these two particular groups, and they're similar groups, is Coldplay and U2, right? Mm-hmm. And their position in rock, like, and as far as how what they represent in bands, right? Mm-hmm. But they're like positioned in pop music still somewhat, right? Mm-hmm. Dude, so many musicians hate both of those bands. Like, they don't just say, I'm not, they hate them.
I mean, right. I don't hate U2. I wouldn't say I hate U2, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
There are so many people that just hate those two bands, but I love Coldplay. I saw them live. I saw U2 live. Great shows. No complaints. Loved it. You know, so it's interesting. Yeah,
you saw U2 live?
Yeah, back in 2009. Nice. Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
My dad used to listen to the Joshua Tree when I was young. And I remember summers. I remember a particular summer my dad was building. He dug to install an in-ground pool, on the above-ground pool for us. And then he built a deck. And he, you know, there was just a lot of yard work happening. I remember playing out in the yard while he was watching me. And he was blasting the Joshua Tree. So, like, right. Where the Streets Have No Name, you know, like... still haven't found what I'm looking for, you know, like, sure. Like all that's all those songs. Yeah. So anyway, so I bought him tickets, him and I tickets to go see them because he's a big U2 fan. So it was great. Yeah. So at the old Giant Stadium right before they knocked it down.
And it's quite topical actually, because I don't know if you remember this, but maybe you can, this is going to test the depth of your music/movie knowledge.
Sure.
U2, specifically Bono, but including U2, created he wrote a movie and created the soundtrack for a movie, did the soundtrack for a movie starring Mel Gibson. Do you remember what the movie was?
Oh God. Hold on. I honestly don't know if I know, but can you tell me, did it come out within the last 20 years?
No, I believe it came out. It was like a turn of the century movie. It was like 99, 2000.
Hmm.
It starred, let me see who it starred here. So Salman Rushdie wrote it as well. Interesting. But I can tell you the movie.
Good.
Seeing as though we're talking about it. It's The Million Dollar Hotel.
I never even heard of it.
Yeah, crazy. It's crazy that we're talking about film music and we got onto you too.
So glad, because I was like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, it popped into my head. I was like, didn't you two create a film? And yeah, they created a movie called The Million Dollar Hotel that I've never seen.
I would watch it. Just
Bono and U2. Yeah, it had Mel Gibson, Mia Jovovich, and I believe Jeremy Davies from Saving Private Ryan, the guy that played Upham in Private Ryan. He's a good actor, but never seen the movie, but it's interesting. We got onto U2. I mean, you can't talk about an Irish musician without talking about Bono and U2, but yeah, they created film music as well, but I've heard it's terrible. So there you go. You don't really need to listen to it or watch it. But yeah, wrapping up the Glenn Hansard thing.
Yeah, I got two. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I have to say that. I'm on Rotten Tomatoes. Dude, it's got like 25%.
What, Million Dollar Hotel?
Yeah, tomato meter. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. When it came out, it wasn't a great movie.
Although the audience score is 67%, so.
Oh, really?
Who knows?
Very odd. Oh, Tim Roth's in it. Wow. I like Tim Roth. He's one of my favorite actors.
I like the Peter Stormare guy, too. I love him.
He's great. So, Glenn Hansard. Go listen to The Frames.
Go watch Once.
There was a Broadway musical made of it.
Yep.
Which was very successful. I don't know if it's still running. Well, I mean, nothing is still running right now, but I don't know if it was still running, but yeah, very, very cool guy, very interesting writer, very, and seemingly a good actor as well. Didn't they win an Oscar for that?
They won some award for sure.
Best song?
They won some. I do remember him talking about that. It was because it was one of those things. They were like, "Holy shit! I didn't know that it was going to take off like this." Kind of.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. It was. I mean, and quite rightly. I mean, the song is, you know, and people always call it "Once." Play "Once."
Oh yeah.
There's a song in it called "Once," I think, and that's not the right song. You start playing "Once," and people are like, "That's not the one I was talking about."
Yes. Yeah.
But no, it was very cool. It's a very cool movie. What did you think when, I mean, obviously you've seen the movie. What did you think about that sequence in the movie where they're recording their demo? What did you think of that? Did it, it brought back like such elemental memories for me. You know, they go into the studio and they record a whole demo overnight, you know?
Yeah. It's different as a drummer, man.
Yeah.
My experience can't be simple recording. My experience recording as a drummer is it involves getting there fucking early and doing, you know, setting up my kit and then them setting up the mics and then doing a sound check. And that's like 3 hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That would be the most boring film sequence. You know what I mean?
The drummers,
like, these people, they just sit down, put take out their guitar, tune, they put a mic up and boom.
Boom, they're recording. It's so yeah.
I wish I can have an experience like that. I got to start like playing another instrument or some bullshit.
I can actually totally relate to it. One of my first recording experiences was 2 days in which we recorded 12 songs.
Oh, I love those.
12 songs in 2 days. They were like two of the longest days of my life. But yeah, 2 days. And we recorded in Salon Studios. So, and it's interesting because when I was watching Once, I was like, I know exactly what that feels like. I know what it's like to be that excited to be going into a studio and recording material that you've written. And, you know,
that's a great feeling.
I totally got it. I thought they did it really well in the movie, and, you know, the kind of camaraderie and the kind of almost melancholy when it's done, because there's a scene in the movie where they're leaving the studio the next morning and like the sun's coming up, and you know, it's kind of like, wow, it's, you know, you've created this thing. And but yeah, that's actually a really good call. Thanks for bringing up that movie, because that's a movie that covers all bases, because it's a movie about music, which is,
it's the perfect, and I've even put a topic in here that we could talk about musicals/musical films, because that when you have something that is exactly what I described before and then also is on Broadway, right? Mm-hmm. it represents like three different worlds of entertainment. Yeah, it's like, you know, you have one of those charts where they have like the three circles, you know,
sure,
and then it's just in the middle of those. Mm-hmm. And yeah, man, it's a perfect. And I heard the musical's good.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, like I heard it's good.
Yeah, it's like it's very difficult being I guess it would be easier if I wasn't an Irish guy, because now it's like,
was it Americanized?
It was, they kept it pretty, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
as far as like the accents meaning.
Yeah. When somebody that I knew went to see it and they were like, it does touch on Busch Gardens, Ireland land a little bit. So when you go to Busch Gardens, there's this like 20 minute show that they put on in the Irish portion of the theme park, which is just like nauseatingly appropriated, you know.
Oh, okay.
And like, people are like, this person that I know that went to see it was like, it kind of, it did okay avoiding that.
Okay.
But then it also kind of got a little bit fucking screwy with the, it went, you know, I mean, yeah, it's, I'd like to go see it. I'd like to see maybe a videoed version of it, a recorded version of it.
We could talk about this because what I like what you're saying is, and maybe you can agree, you could sum it up to musicals, they have to add fat to it. They have to add things because they can't just do the regular narrative. They have to do a song and dance to describe every goddamn emotion. So they'll add bullshit.
Yeah.
It really doesn't need to be there if you're watching a movie, that is.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, you know, I think it's because I saw in the trailers, because obviously Broadway shows advertise on TV, and there was in the trailer for the show, it's like there's a scene where they're like, he's playing in a pub and the people in the pub are like going like that. And I'm like,
oh yeah,
nobody in fucking Ireland does that in a pub. And what I'm doing here is I'm making a gesture of somebody cheersing.
You're doing the yo-ho,
yeah,
yo-ho.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, come on, you know. So, but it's difficult. It's like, you know, it's like people making the Italian hands.
Oh yeah.
You know, in if there's a show about like if there's a Godfather Broadway show, which would be terrible. But
fucking that has to, they give you a gun
when you enter the theater.
Yeah, when they enter the theater, and then that way, just instead of leaving the theater to go blow your brains out, just do it right there.
Just do it right there, yeah. After 4.5 hours of fucking...
Yeah.
But, oh, Jesus, I knocked my mic over. I keep having to unlock my computer here before. I'm not used to this. This is your world I'm entering, Anthony.
Thank you for your patience, everybody, because, you know, we're still getting this, getting this rolling on the technical side. You know, you'll hear Zoom. This is Zoom. So we'll do some in-person ones where Paul and I will play for sure. We'll have, you know, we're going to try our best to get guests that we both know and maybe have played with in person.
Mm-hmm.
And just because that, I think that's the tastiest stuff, man, when we're talking and able to play. So we're going to try. We're going to do our best for that.
Maybe we can even, as soon as they vaccinate us and they allow us to travel, we can do a little tour of the UK podcast tour. That would be fun, right?
That would be great, man.
Yeah,
that would be fantastic.
Be like a podcast / beer tasting tour. We're not allowed to go to Amsterdam, that's all I can say, but this was good. I mean, I enjoyed it. I think we touched on a lot of cool things, and
for sure
it was great to get your opinion on some of these composers and you know, the songs. It made me think I'm gonna go watch like a bunch of these movies now, but I think it's cool, and I think we should definitely do a part two of this because there's so much more to talk about, you know.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. on the note of that, we should shut the fuck up and end this episode because we're like probably over 2 hours in because we just and I on the episode that just came out, I mentioned that, like I said, you know, that was the first episode with Paul. It was great. Obviously you could tell that we can't shut the fuck up. We could just talk for, you know, hours can go by. So you and I will probably get better at like cutting each other, like cutting it off like appropriately, you know.
Yeah,
because we can go on and on, right?
Yeah.
But in that regard, everybody go watch, you especially Paul, go watch this movie. Just won a bunch an award for something. It's called the Sound of Metal.
Oh, with Riz Ahmed. Yeah.
And I honestly, dude, I watched it maybe 2 months ago because it was on Amazon Prime, and I saw a drummer in the photo, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was great. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And he's deaf. He goes deaf, essentially. And it's a whole thing. He was great. I did not know that it's like winning awards and shit like that. It's like, you know, so.
Oh, it's in the Oscar hunt, right?
Yeah. And he did great. And so let's all in the sound of silence or a sound of metal, let's shut the fuck up and wrap this up.
Sounds good to me. Great recommendation on the movie and the shutting the fuck up. Ant, thanks. This was brilliant.
Paul, thank you, sir. Yeah. And thank you, listeners. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. We'll have a lot more for you. All right, everybody. Paul, ba-dum biz to you. Listeners, ba-dum biz to you.